stand by. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, IMS-10 Database and DBRC Enhancements. Today's teleconference will last approximately 60 minutes and will include a live question and answer session. In this teleconference, you'll learn how the new IMS-10 enhancements expand the programming models, such as XML, that may be used with IMS databases. And the speaker for today's teleconference is Rich Lewis, Executive Consulting IT Specialist, IBM Advanced Technical Support for IMS. Now, at this time, I'd like to hand it over to our speaker, Rich Lewis. Please go ahead.
Thanks, and hello to all of you who are listening. This is one of several teleconferences on IMS version 10 that we're doing this year. If you look at page 2 of your handouts, there is a list of all the teleconferences. Some of them have already been done. Replays are available for them, and two more will come up in the future. And there will be a replay of this teleconference after we finish today. So anyone who that you know who missed today's teleconference that you think would be interested in it, it will be available for them, as is also true of those that come in the future. Today I'm going to talk about the enhancements in the database and DBRC areas that come in IMS version 10. Slide 3 lists the enhancements that I'm going to talk about in the database area. So let's go ahead and begin talking about them. Slide 4 mentions that the HALDB ILDS rebuild utility has an enhancement. The ILDS is the indirect list data set. It is the data set that's used in the self-healing pointer process of HALDB. The ILDS contains the accurate locations of targets of secondary indexes and logical relationships. If you lose this data set, you use the index ILDS rebuild utility to rebuild the data set. In the past, this utility has rebuilt the data set by reading the database data set, finding the locations of the targets of secondary indexes and logical relationships, and inserted these entries for these targets into the ILDS. In version 10, there's a new option for the way it works. It still reads the database data set looking for those targets, but instead of directly inserting them into the ILDS, it saves them in a data space. When it's found all of those entries, it sorts those entries that are in the data space and then writes them sequentially and in load mode. The advantage is that this avoids many, many CI and CA splits, and also creates free space if you've defined it in your IDCAMS defines. The utility runs much faster this way, and so the major benefit of the rebuild enhancement is that the utility executes more quickly. It also provides free space for subsequent reorgs, which might put new entries in the ILDS. So it'll be a big enhancement for those rare occasions when you have to rebuild the ILDS. Let's move on and talk about an enhancement to the Image Copy 2 utility. This is an old utility. It's been around since IMS version 4, but it has a new option, and the new option uses fast replication, which invokes flash copy for Shark or ESS devices or DS8000 storage subsystem. This is a big enhancement over the technique that was used in the past. In the past, Image Copy 2 invoked DFSMS DSS dump. Fast replication invokes DFSMS DSS copy with fast replication required on its parameters, and this in turn invokes flash copy. Flash copy is a one-phase copy, unlike the technique used in the past, which was at a logical copy phase and then a physical copy phase. Once the first phase or the only phase is done with flash copy, the copy is complete. The copy must be done to a data set on the same storage subsystem, but when it's done, the copy is an exact duplicate of the original data set. Image Copy 2 with fast replication supports both fuzzy and clean image copies, and DD statements are not required for the output data sets. Since Image Copy 2 produces this new kind of image copy, The database recovery utility must be able to use the new kind of image copy, and support for the database recovery utility is also added in version 10. And it uses flash copy to copy from the image copy data set to the database data set. To use fast replication with image copy in version 10, you must be on ZOS 1.8. Otherwise, version 10 only requires ZOS 1.7. But since there are enhancements to DFSMS in ZOS 1.8 that provide improved support for dataset flash copy, IMS version 10 takes advantage of those enhancements and requires ZOS 1.8 for this facility. The benefits of using Image Copy 2 fast replication is that it does exploit flash copy. If you happen to have an old RVA device, then it will invoke snapshot. This flash copy is done in a single phase. The copies are typically done in seconds. There is minimal CPU resource because almost all the copy work is done by the storage subsystem. It supports both clean and fuzzy image copies. And, of course, there's full GenJCL support for GenJCL IC for the image copy and GenJCL Recov for the subsequent recovery jobs. Slide 7 points out another enhancement in the image copy area in version 10. This is support for fuzzy user image copies. A user image copy is an image copy that you take with a utility or tool that does not have a DBRC interface. We've had support for user image copies in previous releases, but they had to be clean image copies, not fuzzy. In version 10, we've added support for fuzzy user image copies, and to do that, we need two times, not just the image copy time, but the time it stops. So there's a new parameter you specify when you do the notify user image copy, and that's the stop time. DBRC needs to know both the start time and the stop time a fuzzy image copy so it can select the correct logs when a subsequent recovery is done. And, of course, GenJCL Recov has been enhanced to generate the recovery using logs after the fuzzy image copy has been restored. So the benefit of this is that you can integrate fuzzy user image copies into your DBRC environment if you want to take an image copy on your own that invokes that does not invoke a DBRC interface. Slide 8 points out another enhancement in version 10. This is an enhancement to ACVGEM. Back in version 7, we enhanced or increased the number of PCBs that you could have in a PSB with ACVGEM. But we really couldn't quite deliver what we intended to deliver in version 7 because ACVGEM used memory below the 16 meg line. And it would typically run out of memory when trying to build a PCB with more than about 500 PCBs. Version 10 uses storage above the 16 meg line when doing ACVGEM, allowing you to create a PSB with up to the maximum of 2,500 PCBs. As a side, I need to say that we don't recommend that you create a PSB with 2,500 PCBs. Obviously, that can have some performance implications and some implications about the use of your PSB pool. But this enhancement does allow you to create those larger PSBs if you do have a requirement to do so. The next couple of enhancements have to do with changes in commands for FastPath data entry databases. Slide 9 talks about an enhancement to the update database start access command. The update database start access is analogous to a start database command in the type 1 commands. Update database start access is a type 2 command. There's a new parameter you can specify in version 10, and that's area, the subparameter asterisk. That causes IMS to start the database and all of its areas with one command. In previous releases, you would have had to start the areas separately. The only valid parameter after area is asterisk. That is, you cannot specify a single or set of areas or a subset of all the areas. Instead, if you use this capability, you have to start the database and all of the areas. The next command enhancement is shown on slide 10 is a new capability for the update database stop access. That's similar to the type 1 DBR command. With the update database stop access for DEDBs, you can now specify option no rand. When you do this, the randomizer will remain resident even though there may not be any database using those that randomizer. In previous releases, the randomizer would be unloaded if it was not in use by any database. Typically, when you stop access to a DEDB, you're going to start access later, and you're probably not going to change the randomizer. Changing the randomizer is an unusual action. So if you're not going to change it, there's no need to unload it and reload it. And in fact, unloading it and reloading it and doing it many times could cause ECSA fragmentation. And using the option no RAND will eliminate the possibility of that kind of fragmentation. The next enhancement, as shown on slide 11, is an increase in the number of fast path buffers that you're allowed to specify. In previous releases, you could specify 64K minus 1 or 65,535 buffers. In a modern world, with systems growing as large as they have grown, 65,000 buffers is really not a lot of buffers. Even though I'm not sure that any user has reached this limitation, we can certainly see that in the future, it is likely that users will have systems that would benefit from having more than 65,000 buffers. Version 10 allows you to specify up to 4 billion with a B, buffers for FastPath. Now, obviously, you couldn't actually have that many buffers because you would be limited by the amount of storage you have available. But the parameter that you can specify supports values up to that 4 billion so that you can specify a number bigger than 65,000, whatever is appropriate for your system. The next enhancement is also in the area of supporting new larger capacity processors, and that is here we've increased the number of allowable FastPath output threads. In previous releases, the maximum was 255. As you're probably aware, we can have more than 255 dependent regions and might need even more output threads in some situations. Version 10 allows you to specify up to 32K output threads, once again allowing you to exploit larger new processors. The final of the enhancements in the FastPath area is a change in the module DBFCONT0, or CONTO. In previous releases, this module contained many FastPath control blocks and buffers, including MSDBs, if you have them, buffer headers, the buffers themselves for FastPath, output threads, balancing groups. In version 10, this module has been broken up into 5 individual modules. The reason for this is to more efficiently use ECSA storage, because with a very large module, obviously we need a large contiguous area, and it is possible that we wouldn't have room for it. Much more likely we'd have room for the 5 smaller modules. And that concludes the enhancements in the FastPath area. There is one more database enhancement that I want to talk about, and that begins on slide 14. And this is XQuery support for XMLDB. Version 9 added support for XML database. XML database allows IMS to store XML documents in databases and create XML documents from IMS databases. This is support for Java programming. XML database, as you probably are aware, uses JDBC calls and some user-defined functions for the storage of XML documents in IMS databases and the creation of XML documents from the data in IMS databases. What version 10 adds is XQuery support. XQuery can be used to query XML documents and to return newly created XML documents from the data that satisfy the query criteria. XQuery is a World Wide Web Consortium recommendation. That means it's an emerging standard. It is compatible with several other World Wide Web Consortium standards, such as XML itself, namespaces, XPath, XML schema, those kinds of things. The World Wide Web Consortium refers to XQuery by saying that it is to XML documents as SQL is to relational databases, or as we might say, as DL1 is to IMS databases. XQuery allows you to navigate an XML document and the hierarchy of an XML document, and to do a query and return some data from the document or set of documents. XQuery is built on XPath expressions. XPath is the way that XML users specify a navigation through the document. It's somewhat like the way IMS people in the past have used path calls to navigate IMS hierarchies. If you really want to understand XQuery, I recommend that you take a short tutorial that's available on the World Wide Web Consortium webpage. The URL is shown on slide 14. It's probably take you about an hour, maybe a little less, and you will learn a lot about XQuery if you want to. My next slide shows an example of the use of XQuery with XMLDB in version 10. I'm not going to try to explain all about XQuery here, but I want to give you a flavor for what XQuery can do and what it looks like. The query statement on slide 15 shows what otherwise might have been a typical XMLDB select statement, that is a JDBC call using select with retrieve XML, that we could have done in version 9, but in version 10 we're able to add the XQuery to the select statement. If you look in this statement on slide 15, you'll see for $x in /bib/book. $x is the variable that we have specified here. In bib/book is the statement that the variable is going to look in this path in the XML document, bib, the bib element, and the book sub-element within bib, bib being short for bibliography. By the way, the XML document that this query is being done against is shown on the next slide, so you have that for reference. Let's go back to slide 15. We got $x in bib/book. And then there's a where clause. This allows us to specify the criteria of for selection here. We say where $x/price, that is the price sub-element within the book sub-element. Where the price is less than 75 and $x/@sign year, that's the year attribute, and the year is greater than 2004, we're going to select those elements in the document that we're doing the query against. And what we're going to return is shown after the return statement. So return, we're setting up a tag for book, and then within that we've got $x/@sign year, that's the year attribute, $x/title, the title element, etc. And if you look at the bottom of slide 15, you'll see the result of this. We have built part of an XML document, a library element. Within the library, we've got a book sub-element, and within the book element, we've got the year attribute and the title sub-element. And we had two hits, and we returned records for two of the books in our bibliography. As I said, if you really want to understand XQuery, you can go take that tutorial that I mentioned before. But what this really does for our users is allow Java programmers to use the techniques that are common to them. JDBC calls that we introduced in version 9 for selects and inserts. But in version 10, we also allow them to use XQuery, a common way for Java programmers to query XML documents. So now we can really leverage our investment in IMS database by taking those databases that we may have created years ago and allowing Java programmers without a deep understanding of IMS to access the IMS databases and query them using the techniques which they are much likely to be familiar with. That concludes the database enhancements I wanted to talk about today. So now let me move on to the DBRC enhancements. The ones I'm going to talk about are shown on slide 17. And let me begin with the first one on slide 18. That's DBRC timestamp precision. In version 10, DBRC timestamps will be recorded to the microsecond. In previous releases, timestamps were recorded to the tenth of a second, even though some records had room in them for recording down to the microsecond. We only used a tenth of a second as the last significant part of the time. IMS's logic for looking in the recons only looked to the tenth of a second. The reason for this change is to avoid the possibility of duplicate timestamps. As processors get faster and faster, there is the possibility that was looming on the horizon that log open times or close times or alloc times might show up as duplicates because multiple occurrences will happen within a tenth of a second. To eliminate these possibilities for the foreseeable future, the timestamps are now going to be recorded to the microsecond. This will only happen once you have set min version to version 10. The min vers parameter says only IMS systems at this release or higher can use this set of recons. So min vers 10.1 says only version 10 IMS systems can use the recons. Once we know all of the IMS systems using the set of recons, or in version 10, we can start using and enforcing these microsecond timestamps. There is really no change for the user in this change to the internals of IMS because you can still specify timestamps that aren't to the microsecond or even to the tenth of a second. As you're probably aware, if you specify a timestamp to DBRC, DBRC will, you know, if you specify it to the hour, it'll fill in 0 minutes and 0 seconds. If you specify it to the minute, it will fill in 0 seconds, etc. So there's no change to the externals, but internally you will see more precise timestamps, and you may notice them in your recon listings. The next set of enhancements to DBRC are shown on slides 19 and 20. 19 talks about read-only support for the recons. Version 10 adds a change to security authorization. It allows you to specify that this user will only do read with a PARM read-only on the DBRC utility, that utility we use for DBRC commands, or if you're using the DBRC API that was introduced in version 9, you can specify read-only equal yes. If you specify that, then obviously the user can only read or do list recon commands, but they only need read authority to do so, and the recons will be open for input. That says that if you have, let's say, a new DBA that needs to be able to list recon records, you can give that person read-only authority, or read authority, and they specify read-only, they can get their work done, but they don't have the capability of making the updates to the recons. There may be circumstances where that's advantageous in your installation. Related to this change is a change that's shown on slide 20. And that is a general change to SAF, or RACF, authority for recons. Read authority is sufficient for readers, those that specify read-only. Update is sufficient now for accesses, except for actual deletes and defines of the recon data sets. Alter is required for delete and define, of course, and control is never required. Control authority was required for all recon accesses in previous releases. That says before version 10, any user who accesses the recons would have SAF authority to do anything to the recons, including to delete them. That's not true in version 10. Version 10 has a more rational kind of authority scheme Readers only need read. Updaters only need update. Only those that are going to delete and define recon data sets need alter authority. So that's a stricter enforcement of security for DBRC, giving you a more secure set of recons. The next enhancement talks about the DBRC API. The DBRC API was introduced in version 9. It provides an assembler language interface for accessing the recons. The DBRC API allows users to get data out of the recons. It doesn't return recon records. Instead, it returns the data from the recon records. This makes the interface release independent. If you have written something in version 9, it will continue to run the same way in version 10, even though some of the recon records have changed in version 10. Same thing, if you wrote something in version 9, it'll continue to run unchanged in future versions of IMS. In version 9, all we delivered was a query capability. Version 10 provides an update capability and some other capabilities as shown on slide 11. The first big change, of course, is the capability to update the recons. The updates are done by issuing NIT, change, and notify commands. That is, users will not be allowed to make just any updates to the recons because by doing so, they could make inconsistent updates to different records in the recons. By restricting updates to what you can do with a NIT, change, or notify commands, we protect the integrity of the recons. Other enhancements are extensions to query other kinds of records, or more easily to specify wildcards in queries. Also in version 10, it makes it easy for one application program, one assembler language program, to look at multiple recons because version 10 allows you to specify multiple DD names for different sets of recons. Version 9, the DD names had to be Recon 1, Recon 2, and Recon 3. In version 10, you can still use Recon 1, Recon 2, and Recon 3, but you can also add other Recon DD names for other sets of recons and specify them when you do your start DBRC macro. Other enhancements in version 10 include the capability for your application program to register as a subsystem and to authorize databases. You may have a need for this, but it's not as likely as the need that tools vendors have. This will allow tools vendors to write tools that do things that otherwise utilities would do, such as image copies, reargs, those kinds of tools that need authorization for databases. It will allow those vendors to use this interface. And once they use this interface that's release independent, when they go to future releases of IMS, they won't have to make changes to their tools to support the new release doing the same thing they did in the old release. We think that'll free up their resources to do more productive things by adding enhancements to their tools for your benefit. And finally, there is now SAF or RACF invocation by the DBRC API application programs. That's an extension to DBRC command authorization. That is, if you're going to access the recons with a DBRC API in version 10, you will need the same kind of authority you would need with SAF to do a similar kind of function using a command. Obviously, it's exactly the same command for NIT, change, and notify. For the query commands, it's the same thing as doing a list command. So what we've done in version 10 is more or less completed the API interface, giving not only read capability for the recons, but update capability. The final thing I'm going to talk about in the DBRC area today is parallel recon access, a big change for accessing the recons. This is an optional facility in version 10. You do not have to use it, but some users may want to use it. Parallel recon access allows multiple DBRC instances to access the recons concurrently. A DBRC instance is an IMS online subsystem, or DB control, or IMSTM, or a batch job, an IMS batch job, DLI or DBB, or a utility, either a DBRC utility or a utility like Image Copy or Database Recovery or any of those utilities that need to access the recons. As I'm sure you are aware, in version 9 and all previous releases, only one DBRC instance can be accessing the recons at any time, and this is controlled by data set reserve that you can convert to a global enqueue, but nevertheless says only one access to the recons at any time. Version 10 with parallel recon access allows multiple DBRC instances to be accessing the recons at the same time. This can obviously reduce recon contention and provide for a more responsive DBRC for IMS own lines and batch jobs and remove a growth constraint. As I mentioned before, this is optional. It's specified with a DBRC command I will show you in a minute. As slide 24 mentions, there are some prerequisites for the use of PRA or parallel recon access. PRA uses transactional vSAM. Transactional vSAM is a system facility that provides locking, logging, caching, and commit protocols for concurrent updates to a vSAM dataset by exploiting parallel sysplex. Transactional vSAM is really data sharing for vSAM, just as block-level data sharing for IMS allows multiple IMS systems to access and update databases at the same time, or data sharing for DB2 allows multiple DB2 subsystems to access and update DB2 databases at the same time. Transactional vSAM allows multiple vSAM users, in this case DBRCs, to access and update the recons at the same time. It does require parallel sysplex, and therefore needs parallel sysplex hardware. Specifically, it needs or requires a coupling facility because it's going to place coupling facility structures in its coupling facility or coupling facilities. There's also a software requirement. Transactional vSAM is a capability or a facility of DFSMS, DFSMS TVS as it's called. TVS itself requires RRS. That does not mean that IMS must have the RRS parameter set to yes or Y for IMS's own use, only that RRS must be in your system for TVS to use. TVS is an optional feature of DFSMS. That means there's a software license required, but for IMS users who are going to use TVS and their only use of TVS is for DBRC recons, then special bids will be considered. That means you can get a price break. TVS was designed for data sharing use of high-volume vSAM data sets. Typically, we would think, probably in a CICS environment, many CICS environments have lots of vSAM data sets, and lots of batch jobs that need to do updates to the vSAM data sets, and if that's the case, then they can benefit by TVS. But typically, they might have hundreds of vSAM data sets. In our case, we've just got the recons, and if that's all we're using it for, you can get a price break on the license for TVS. Slide 25 shows a high-level overview of a TVS environment for DBRC. TVS uses a cache structure in the coupling facility and a buffer pool in the SMS vSAM address space. As the diagram shows, there's two LPARs here. Each LPAR contains an IMS online system. I've shown an IMS batch job in each one and an IMS utility in each one. Obviously, there could be multiple utilities, multiple batch jobs, and even multiple IMS online systems. Each of these is a DBRC instance. When one of these online systems or batch jobs or utilities needs to access the recons, it goes to DBRC. DBRC needs to access the recons, and with TVS, it goes to the SMS vSAM address space to to process that vSAM request. There is a buffer pool in the SMS vSAM address space in which CIs from the recons are read and kept. A buffer pool much like a full function database buffer pool or a FastPath database buffer pool in IMS. I say it's more like full function because once you've read a CI in the buffer pool, it just sits around forever and, or not forever, until the buffer is needed for some other CI. So one DBRC may read a recon record into the buffer pool, and another instance of DBRC may benefit by finding that CI in the buffer pool and not having to read it from the recon. But, of course, we've got two LPARs. Each one has a vSAM address space. Each one has a buffer pool. And if one LPAR updates a CI, then we need to invalidate that buffer in the other LPAR if the same CI is in a buffer there. So we have to have all the normal data sharing protocols. We have to have locking, buffer invalidation, and we need logging. And so we have a cache structure for buffer invalidation purposes. We have lock structure for locking purposes. We have logger structure for our logging to support our vSAM data sharing environment, which we call TVS. There are lots of recovery capabilities, and integrity is built into TVS. As slide 26 shows, there is recovery for all kinds of failures. I'm going to mention the ones I think that first might come to mind. Let's think of what happens in a TVS environment with PRA, Parallel Recon Access, if an IMS DBRC instance fails, like your batch job admin. If that's the case, then each TVS instance has an undo log. The undo log has the before images of the CIs or the L records in the recon data sets. And if you're doing some updates to the recons and you have been, we're going to back out those updates by using that undo log. If IMS online system batch job or utility fails and it's done some updates to the recons but has not committed them, we're going to back them out, just as we would do back out IMS database updates if a transaction had partially run and failed before it committed. The next failure we might want to think about is, what happens if our SMS vSAM address space fails? In that case, the operating system automatically restarts that address space, and any user of that address space that was doing updates to the recons at the time of the failure would have failed. And so when the address space comes back up, we're going to use the undo log and back out the in-flight work and release locks and continue on. Another type of failure is, what happens if I lose the entire LPAR? In that case, we use something called peer recovery. If one LPAR fails, the SMS vSAN address space on the other LPAR, or another LPAR if there are more than two, one of them does what's called peer recovery. It backs out all the in-flight work that was in progress on the failed LPAR, releases locks, and allows work to continue. There's lots of other recovery built into TVS, but I just want to give you an idea that it's really a full data sharing capability for vSAM data sets like the recons. As slide 27 shows, the way to choose to use PRA is to issue a change recon or building a new recon set, then with a NIT recon command to specify access parallel. The default is serial, or it's going to be serial is what you're using today. And when you upgrade your recons, you'll still be serial until you do a change recon and make it parallel. Interestingly enough, the change can be done while IMS is running, or while IMSs are running, or DBRC instances are running. You can do it at any time, provided you have the right environment to support PRA. The right environment is shown on slide 28. First, of course, your recons have to be at MinVerse version 10. Version 9, version 8 can't support parallel recon access. And all users of the recon have to understand we're doing parallel, or all users have to understand we're doing serial processing. PRA requires a TVS environment. A TVS environment requires several things, and among those things are the things listed here on slide 28. For example, there's an IGD SMS HormLab member. This specifies the TVS parameters. You have to have coupling facility structures and log streams defined in your parallel sysplex definitions. You have to have a share control data set, control data sets that keep track of which vSAM data sets are being shared with TVS. RACF authority has to be set up appropriately. You have to have RRS running. You have to have your SMS vSAM address spaces defined and running. And obviously, you're going to change the recovery procedures and operations for your recons. The way that you manage your recons changes. There are lots of advantages of using PRA, but it is a significant change in your environment, and that's why it's optional. As slide 29 shows, parallel recon access has lots of benefits. It is there to reduce recon contention. So PRA will typically be used by high-volume IMS users, and particularly those who have high-volume access to the recons. High-volume access to the recons oftentimes occurs when you run lots of batch jobs or lots of database utilities that all need to access the recons. If you have a high number of concurrent jobs running, you might have high recon access. Therefore, PRA will reduce contention, increase throughput, and reduce the interference between online systems and batch jobs as they access the recons and remove this growth constraint. This is the first step in changes to DBRC. This one is a very significant change in enhancing the capabilities, especially in the area of volume, for DBRC. Slide 30 just sums up. We've made a lot of changes in version 10. Other teleconferences will talk about other changes, but I'm today just talking about those enhancements to database and DBRC. They're listed here. They cover things such as we have seen, integration, like support for XQuery and new programming capabilities for Java programmers, lots of enhancements to security both for DBRC and recons and in other areas, lots of changes, improve the performance and increase the capacity and improve the ease of use of IMS systems. That concludes my talks, and now I'm going to return the call back to the operator.
Rich, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to ask you to participate in a brief survey just before taking questions from you. Also, we'd like to acknowledge that some of you may have experienced some audio difficulty, and we'd like to let you know we appreciate your patience when reconnecting. Now, for the audio survey, we'll ask you to respond to several questions using your telephone keypad. Simply press the star key followed by the digit that corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all possible response options before you make your selection. So first, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. Or if it was low, press star 3. We'll pause for just a moment. Question 2, how was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference? If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. Or if it was more technical than you needed to hear, press star 3. Moving on now to question 3, which version of IMS are you currently running? If it's version 9, press star 1. If it's version 8, press star 2. Or version 7, press star 3. Finally, we hope you've enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you're interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If you would like some more information or follow-up, press star 1. If not, press star 2. Again, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your participation in the survey. Now we'd like to move on to taking questions from you. And again, we'll ask you to use your telephone. If you have any questions, simply press star 1 on your telephone keypad and make sure, if you would, please, that your mute button is not engaged. So once again, for any questions, press star 1 now, please. First up, Rich, we have a question from Deb Watson at Bank of America.
Morning, Rich. Thank you very much for the presentation. I just have some questions about the PCBs and the update command for fast path areas.
Okay.
First of all, with this limit of 2,500 PCBs, I mean, you don't recommend that as a realistic limit, I'm sure. Do you have a realistic limit?
No, I really don't. I mean, the requirement came about, in my understanding at least, I was told that the requirement came about because there was a vendor who wanted to have a product that allowed you to access any segment of any database in your system. Obviously, you need a PSB with a PCB for every database and a SynSeg for every segment. And that was the original requirement. You know, if you really have an application requirement to access lots of segments, the way to do it is to, you know, create the big PSB. I think that would be better than artificially creating many PSBs and doing program-to-program message switches or something to get to the right one and, you know, accessing five databases using five transactions or something like that. But I really don't have a limit. It's just kind of a warning that really big PSBs are going to take a lot of space in PSB pool or resident PSB space.
I could, in our environment, I could see us getting to a PSB where we're accessing 500 databases.
Right. And yeah, large installations like yours, that could be. And I don't have any reason to tell you not to try to do it. It's just, you know, it's going to take a lot of space in your PSB pool, but systems are large now. Or you might have to make that PSB resident anyway, and then it's not really in your pool, but it's still taking space.
Okay, and the other question I have has to do with the update area asterisk command. Do you have a realistic performance limit on the number of areas that might be assigned where that command, I mean, diminishing returns on doing that command with an asterisk?
No, I really don't. I'm not aware of any benchmark or study that's been done in that area.
Okay, and then my last question, we're at the point now where we would like to be able to change some of our FastPath areas of a particular database to read-only and leave the other ones available for update. Do you have any capabilities along those lines, or is something coming that direction?
Repeat that. You want to make some of the areas read-only but other areas update-capable of one database?
Yes.
No. No, I don't know. I'm not aware of a requirement. There may be a requirement. I'm personally not aware of it. But if you do have a requirement, you know, make it known and it will be considered.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have. Appreciate
it. You're welcome, Deb.
Next up, we have a question from Lawrence Altman at MetLife.
Hey, Rich. This is Larry.
Hi.
I have, first of all, I guess a general question. I'm wondering how this and or the set of similar version 10 database enhancements and recon enhancements compares to the IOD session that's on Wednesday of the same name, since they're both about an hour.
And they're both about an hour, and they're both given by Rich Lewis. I would say the content is very similar.
Okay.
So if you heard this one and you think you learned it all, you might want to go somewhere else at IOD.
I'm going to do that.
Okay.
Regarding the API interface, is it still only assembler programs that can be involved with that, or is there anything for Rex?
It's just assembler language. Really what it is a set of assembler language macros.
Okay, so that hasn't changed. All right. Very good then. Thank you.
You're welcome.
No questions holding at the moment. Again, I'd like to invite everyone to ask a question by pressing star 1. Star 1 on your phone, please, if you have any questions. Rich, at this point, it appears we have no further questions, so I'll turn things over to you for any additional comments or closing remarks you might have.
Well, thank you. I have no additional comments other than I want to thank those who called in today for listening, and I guess a reminder from what Larry said. The IoD conference is coming up, and if you would like to learn more about version 10 and more details about many areas of version 10, the IoD conference is a great place to go. That's it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again very much for joining us today. That will conclude the teleconference. Have a good day.